Community Cats podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Welcome to the Community Cats podcast. I am your host, Stacey LeBaron. I've been involved helping homeless cats for over 20 years with the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society. The goal of this podcast is to expose you to amazing people who are improving the lives of cats. I hope these interviews will help you learn how you can turn your passion for cats into action. Today, we're speaking with Carmen DiCenzo and Mike Kiley. Carmen has had a long and distinguished career in animal welfare and human services and has been recognized as a leader and innovator. In August of 2016, he was named executive director at Dakin Humane Society, where he oversees all aspects of the organization's work at its two locations in Leverett and Springfield, Mass. Dakin has more than 50 employees and nearly 800 volunteers who shelter, treat, and foster more than 20,000 animals annually. Mike Kiley is the director of adoption centers and programs at the MSPCA. Mike oversees four adoption centers, which include adoption centers and spay-neuter clinics in Methuen, Boston, and Cape Cod. The Methuen campus includes an equine and farm animal adoption center. In addition to the small animal adoption center, Mike also oversees the MSPCA's community outreach programs. Each year, the MSPCA helps over 20,000 animals through its various programs. Carmen and Mike, I'd like to welcome you to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So for folks that maybe haven't been to some of the New England Fed conferences and the HSUS Expo conferences, the two of you have been on the road for the last couple of years and have been doing a show. So I'm thrilled to have you with me today together. So it's great. You both have been working in the field for, I hate to say, a long, long time, but as long as I have. And so I thought we would first start off with Mike, maybe first talking about your experiences with regards to community cats in New England. What have the trends been? What are you seeing around the country? Maybe you could comment on that first, and then we would swing over to Carmen.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you think we're going back to when I first started in animal welfare in 1994, the trend was pretty one note, where it was just an overwhelming sea of cats being surrendered to us from various situations of owner surrender, stray, abandon, law enforcement seizures, feral cats being trapped. And I think our outlook on cats and community cats back then was really just essentially dealing with an unwinnable situation in which we were dealing with a crush of animals coming through, in that much of what we were providing wasn't necessarily a strategic approach to dealing with cats, but more so dealing with an overpopulation problem in a way that we could best at that time, which was take as many as we could, adopt out as many as we might be able to find homes for, and then make decisions for euthanasia on the rest. And I think over time, I think that has been probably the number one reason why our staff have left the organization over time and volunteers, because of the emotional stress of euthanasia, as well as the physical toll of dealing with so many cats. So I think what's been exciting in the last 5 years on my end is that we have formulated a strategy both for adoption as well as for targeted spay-neuter and dealing with different populations of cats in different ways. And I think we're now at the point where, largely in New England, we are not dealing with an overpopulation of cats any longer. And that is most definitely something I would not have imagined when I first started in this field.
What about you, Carmen?
Yeah, you know, I'd probably say pretty similar to what Mike has experienced, that, you know, throughout the years. I mean, I remember coming into this field, and the idea of trap neuter release was actually extremely controversial. I mean, I remember kind of being in the room when discussions were being had of how this, you know, we shouldn't be doing this and euthanasia is a better option. And obviously we've, over the years, that's evolved and changed. And not only did we see TNR for, you know, feral free roaming cats, but return to field and other options for cats that are social, but, you know, like maybe an outdoor life is just okay for them. So it's interesting to see those changes. And I think some of the bigger changes, as Mike said, with a lower population of cats in our shelters, we are actually able to be more creative with the programs we have. And, you know, regularly for the past 3 years here at Dakin, we are able to take cats that are, you know, under 12 weeks of age that are acting completely unsocialized, put them on our adoption floor, and through our Spirit Kitten program, have them in homes and have actually great success in homes, which I probably never would have seen coming, that we would take, you know, literally a cat that was born outdoors, had never seen a human, and be able to put them in a home and have a public that's embracing that and very happy to adopt those cats.
One of the things that I find when I'm talking with folks from all around the country is I get this feeling, people go, well, in New England, you maybe have it all set, but we won't ever be able to get there. What would you say to that kind of comment, Carmen?
I would say we said the same thing. We never thought we would get there. And certainly, I mean, I think we saw it coming sooner with dogs, but I was actually surprised, especially over the last couple of years, how dramatic the shift was. You know, we started to see fewer and fewer. I think what we first started to see was we were seeing fewer litters of kittens that were born in a home. So, you know, essentially people that had a cat at their house that was either intentionally or unintentionally became pregnant. You know, those litters used to come to our shelters, and little by little, those weren't the cats or kittens we were seeing. We were seeing kittens born outdoors as really the biggest part of our population. And we think a lot of that has to do with people are able to find, as our shelters have fewer cats and kittens in them, it's easier for someone that has a litter of kittens to place them on their own without the use of a shelter, which ultimately was our goal. You know, I do remember when I started in shelters, we always said to people that were surrendering, are there other options? Have you tried to place animals on their own? And I've kind of seen this kind of shift in the field now that people are doing that. There's a little bit of fear of like, oh no, people are doing this thing on their own that we wanted them to do. It's really interesting. And so again, to other parts of the country, it probably is there. And start to look at the trends of the numbers. And I think you'll notice that you'll probably start to see that decline as well.
And what do you think, Mike, about that? And maybe also comment on like, what are the magic components that really impacted Massachusetts with the substantial drop in population coming into the shelters?
Yeah, and I mean, I think I completely agree with Carmen. And I think one of the things that is challenging for people who work directly in animal shelters with cats is that if all of your cages are full, you feel like nothing is changing. And so it's very easy, I think, for us to slip into this tendency to say, it's not going to happen in our shelter because we are still dealing with this large number of cats. And I think one of the things that's been a major change in animal welfare is actually looking at statistics to determine whether anything is changing, and also to look at statistics within our community so that we can formulate plans and how we might be able to make those things shift. So I think for us, you know, the big change that happened, you know, the kind of formula that worked for us is that we first needed to deal with our in-house population issues first. So we had a lot of cats coming in, and in Massachusetts, we were experiencing larger numbers of intake when other organizations started to see a decrease. And that was largely due to our admission style of being open admission. And so we didn't see a change until we started to sort of force a change in our communities. And that started with doing fee-waived adoption events during the busiest times of our years when we were feeling overwhelmed and feeling like we were under the weight of cats. And just being able to get a moment in the middle of August to be able to breathe and to think clearly and strategize when we had been going for such a long period of time from June to December with just being overwhelmed with care, having some of the animals get adopted in large groups gave us a moment to feel a little bit more stable. And then we were able to launch plans from there once our adoption program started working and started looking at our statistics to see where were the cats coming from. And what might we be able to do to decrease the number of cats coming into our adoption centers in the first place? And that's when we started our targeted spay-neuter in our communities. It was where I was working at the time in Methuen, was Lawrence, Lowell, Haverhill, and Methuen. And to be able to offer low-cost spay-neuter programs to the public, we saw an immediate change in the intake numbers. And it just continued from there. And now we're at the state where we're working with animals that are more difficult to place and dealing with that challenge. And also, I think looking forward to how might we be able to go from a reactive phase to a more proactive phase and being able to work with people who own cats in our community from a direct community outreach and to be able to help them in a different way.
Carmen, do you have any thoughts there?
It's the Mike and Carmen show because I think we do agree so often on things. So I would definitely second everything that he says as well. But really, that I think that is the bigger shift is that we are seeing more challenging animals in our adoption centers. Even now, I can tell you in our adoption center, we have a fair number of cats for adoption, but the cats on our direct adoption floor that, you know, your average person can walk in and see are fewer than they were before, because our cats are in offices, they're in foster homes, they are in our barn cat program room, which, you know, isn't necessarily a room that people are going to just walk on in. So definitely a huge shift in that population of, hey, there's just too many cats and anyone should walk in, can walk in here, and we can have a cat that will match your style. We're dealing more with cats that have behavior, medical, or a combination of those, and we're finding our adoptions are actually becoming a little more specialized. I think one other thing I would just point out with, I bet you there's people listening to this that would say, you know, there still are pockets of New England that are experiencing overpopulation and that are overwhelmed. And what I would challenge there, though, is it truly overpopulation and being overwhelmed, or is it the lack of ability to let go of animals in your care? So if you as an individual shelter in a region that is vastly seeing a decrease in the number of shelter animals, if your individual organization is still seeing an increase, you may want to look at your adoption policies, your intake policies, and, you know, are you, you know, hanging on to animals that would be able to be placed because of fear of different policies, or someone's not going to adopt them the quote unquote correct way, or do, you know, have open adoption. So I would challenge that, because I have heard that there are pockets that still have overpopulation. And I think we should define that overpopulation is very, very different than not allowing your animals to leave your shelter.
We're proud to be an affiliate of Space Kitty Express, makers of handmade, refillable catnip alternative cat toys. Think Valerian, Silver Vine, Honeysuckle, etc. for the discerning cat who wants to try something new or doesn't respond to catnip. You can even get 10% off your purchase at Space Kitty Express by using the code COMMUNITYCATS at checkout. Help your kitty blast off today with some new toys from www.spacekittyexpress.com. Did you miss the 2018 online cat conference that we held in January? Or would you like to share some of the conference webinars with friends? You can now purchase the presentations and share them with colleagues and friends. Just visit our recordings page, which is under the Resources tab, to access webinars from some of the leading personalities in feline welfare today. They're sure to give you and your cat-loving friends great ideas on ways to help even more cats. Check it out at www.communitycatspodcast.com. Yeah, and I'd also say we have possible pockets of population that I would call them sort of the undocumented cats, and that they are out there, and it's just that our programs aren't necessarily reaching them. I don't know if you'd have any thoughts on that, but I think that as we take deeper dives into communities, I wrote down here in my notes, I was sort of thinking about Pets for Life Plus, or 2.0, Pets for Life 2.0, because Mike was touching upon some of the topics about sort of the wellness and care for the cats in the community. We've put a ton of resources into spaying and neutering a lot of these cats for either free or very low, which is like $10 at the MSPCA. But then as these cats age, they're going to need other care. So I think it's going to be a bit more as we move forward, you know, not wanting to take these cats in. But there are also pockets of cats that maybe need assistance that just the community outreach is not there. And Mike, you had mentioned looking forward about more community outreach and more engagement enabling people to keep their cats in their homes and looking at crafting programs in a different way. I don't know if you would be able to expand on that a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we are starting, we basically launched on May 1st out of our Boston location to do a Pets for Life program out of the zip code of 02121, which is in Dorchester. And so we're in our first month and recognizing some of the things that we anticipated, which is spay and neuter is obviously an important component. And I would suspect that the pockets that people are referring to probably are in areas where poverty is prevalent and that their access to affordable care is probably pretty low. So I think we are seeing pockets, but largely those pockets are there not because people aren't willing to spay and neuter their animals and not wanting to do that, but really just transportation, affordable spay and neuter and affordable care in general, access to any other types of pet supplies and pet food is just challenging for people who are living in poverty that many of us can't really relate to. And I think we are certainly seeing, so what's interesting about Dorchester is that we have started that process, and what we're finding is that exactly what we might have anticipated. We offered spay-neuter at a low cost of $10 for people in that community already before we started going door-to-door. So we are finding that many of the cats and many of the owners that we're talking to, their cats are already spayed and neutered. Their dogs are not, because we haven't had an overreaching dog program for that. So we're already finding that some of our programs have already worked from a spay-neuter standpoint. But we are seeing just what you suggested, people dealing with chronic issues with their cats, whether it be flea infestations that are chronic or ear-related issues, ear mites or ear infections. And I think one of the things that we knew we would stumble upon is dental care for cats. I think when you look at dental care, it's probably the least affordable process for anybody, even people who are not dealing with poverty. Even for myself, if I didn't have our discount at our Angel Animal Medical Center, it would be hard for me to afford our dental care for our cats. And it's very prevalent within the feline species. So I think when I think back onto what our organization started for, it was to protect animals and to help people. And I think it's one of those things where there is some inherent suffering that may be happening in our community from animals that are suffering from dental disease and has a potential solution, but doesn't yet have a pathway for people to get that affordably. I agree, we're going to be dealing with a lot of those types of those issues. And I'm excited to try to problem solve around that, because I do think I would hate to see people having to give their animals up that they care about and have kept in their households for 12 to 13 years and then have to separate from them because they can't afford something like a dental surgery.
Carmen, I think you might have been, when you were in Providence, might have been one of the first organizations to bring Pets for Life up to New England. So maybe for folks that might not be specifically familiar with the program, what does it really entail?
Sure. Yeah, we were part of the first mentorship group back in 2012 when the HHUS opened up that program for mentors. There were 10 cities throughout the country chosen, and Providence was one of them that was working there. So I think really the takeaways from that program and really the essence of it, it was pretty eye-opening for me with, being in Providence, which is, very small. I mean, Rhode Island in general is pretty small. I did my training for Pets for Life in Philadelphia, which, one of the zip codes in Philadelphia is the size of all of Providence. So we were focusing on some zip codes that we identified areas of need. And I think what was really eye-opening to me was how right in our backyard there were pockets, neighborhoods that really did not know what we did for services. We had this perception that everyone in Providence knew about us and knew what we did. And, as we got into the community, knocking on doors, making relationships, we really started to realize, like, wow, people don't really know what we're here for. And I think one of the things that hit me, an example I can give is I remember being with one of the outreach volunteers. We were at a home, working with a family, and in the hallway was a cat and her kittens. And so we asked, like, oh, is this your cat? Is it someone else in the building? And it wasn't theirs. And basically everyone in the building kind of was chipping in and feeding the cat and taking care of them, and offered to them that, if you're unable to care for these cats, or, we can actually help through the shelter. And they had no idea that was a service offered, that they could actually take, the mom and kittens to the shelter to be placed. And I guess that, that's a scenario that happened over and over, is that, there are communities just placing animals on their own completely without our assistance. So what, being in those neighborhoods and being in areas we hadn't been, it did give us an opportunity to kind of help enhance the lives of the animals and the people in that community, because we are able to provide, access to veterinary care. Again, it's kind of really basic wellness, vaccines, relief from fleas and other kind of parasites. But it was interesting. I guess it was just really eye-opening. I think we have this assumption that, everyone knows about the shelter and we help all these animals, and we're really only touching a very, very small percentage of the animals. And I think was the most eye-opening.
I think it's very true. I think it's important for small and large organizations, any organization out there, to really get involved in their local community, whether it's a city like Providence or, you know, a small suburban town. I think being able to be out there and in the community is really important. And I think that the vaccination clinics are a great way to do that, because it's sort of like providing a little bit of a carrot to get people to come out, you know, to do vaccines and microchipping ideally. And so I think that that is very helpful. And I believe that's sort of like the first step with Pets for Life as a way to sort of get into the communities.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to ask you both a sort of a trick question. How about that? Mm-hmm. For the Mike and Carmen show. All right.
Got your journalism.
So you each have $100. You can spend that $100 on either, or you can divide it up in however you would like. Low cost spay neuter for cats, trap neuter return, or an adoption program. How would you divide up that $100 for those three programs? And if I forgot something, you can add another category.
Beer? Could beer be a category?
Oh, then the 100 is gone already.
I was waiting for that one to enter into the conversation.
You know, I don't know that I separate low-cost spay neuter and TNR 100% of the time. I think on our the dollars that we have are really about treating the whole cat. And I think, you know, one of the things that I always am interested to hear people's perspective on is about when we only maybe do one of these programs in each location, what ends up being the most effective? If we did TNR and not low-cost spay neuter for the public, or if we only did low-cost spay neuter for the public and TNR and not do TNR, you know, are we able to have the greatest effect on our community? You know, one might argue that low-cost spay neuter for the public is helping to prevent the future colonies in that community. But I ultimately think that the best possible plan for an approach to spay neuter is to do both, because I think we have to treat the whole cat. We have to treat the animals that might be free roaming in people's homes, might be abandoned at a later point in some situations, or might be breeding in some other ways, along with the feral cat colonies that we're seeing. And I think overall, if I had $100, I would probably spend $50 on low-cost spay neuter for the public and $50 on TNR, because it would solve probably a lot of the reasons why we had an adoption program to begin with. So that would be my gut response to that.
Carmen?
All right. When you first asked that question, my initial thought was I'd do 50-50 between TNR and spay neuter, and I would, because I think adoption is kind of starting to fade away and it's not becoming that primary program. But thinking about it, I would put some of the funds, a smaller portion of it, into the adoption portion of it, because I don't think we can look at anything from just one lens. And the reality is, you know, with TNR, some of those cats actually might not need to be released. So the adoption program, I think, you know, looking at the TNR component, that some of those cats actually, because it's such a mix now of, you know, are they truly non-social? Are they social? That often those cats you come across actually might be able to be transitioned to a home. So I think you want to keep some resources toward that, but I probably would put, you know, maybe 20 into the adoption and then split the rest equally between the other two.
So here's actually, sorry to jump in,
yeah,
but I think this is actually kind of an area that I think is a good debate. And I'm not sure Carmen and I disagree on this one, but I think it's a good jumping off point. Carpal, I'll ask you a question, Carmen, is what is your feeling on the idea of moving away from TNR and, you know, or however you want to describe it, but basically identifying cats that are free roaming, spaying and neutering and returning them to the same location, or if you're finding friendly ones in that group, retaining those for adoption. Do you feel like there's a controversy there by any chance?
Yeah, I think there probably is controversy because, one, do we truly know that they're free roaming or someone's outdoor cat? And I think that's one of the things we're struggling with now and actually are kind of changing some programming here. Because we know a number of the cats that people bring to us that they found in the neighborhood likely lived with someone. And the reality is when they do kind of come back into our adoption program, the chances of them ever reuniting with that home are probably less than 1%. I don't know. That's a really interesting question, and I'm not sure what the right answer is, which is, quite frankly, often the work we do, there's never one right or wrong answer. It's a giant area of gray in decision-making. But I do wonder if that's the right move, is just taking cats from where they are. I don't know that is always the right thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I worry about it a lot because I do think if I were going to say a change that I've seen happen over time is that when there was shelters that were filled with cats and struggling to find homes with cats, people were pretty on point with returning those animals to the community. And it was never really a question that came up that if you trapped a cat, regardless of whether it's friendly or seemingly feral, those animals would just get spayed, neutered, ear tipped, and vaccinated, and then returned to the community they came of, and no one really thought twice about it. And now I think we're seeing a lot of people being conflicted in that we're seeing a lot of not only trapping and then putting into shelters, but those animals being trapped that might be friendly and then being transferred to a shelter that's not anywhere near where the animal is located, which I think gives people almost zero chance of finding their animal if it was a cat that was just indoor-outdoor cat that someone cared about, loved, maybe didn't spay or neuter, but ultimately might be looking for their cat, and that cat's been relocated to a totally different area for adoption. And I think that's a challenge that we're going to have as an animal welfare community is, do we stay strong with leaving the cats where they are and providing the spay, neuter, and vaccinations, or is it our role to try to make a judgment call about rehoming those animals? And I think that that's kind of a dangerous crossroads for us to have to debate about.
So I'm going to jump in and just share some of the historical sort of data that I know, which is, like, in Newburyport, when we first started out with those 300 cats on the waterfront, I would say we initially pulled off in the first year or two about 60% of the population between being friendly adults and kittens. Those cats were determined, and it was a very targeted area. So it's one of those conversations where the more targeted your area, the better you know the community, the better you know you've talked to the neighbors. So you know, oh, well, you know, Sylvester over there, you know, Sally Sue feeds Sylvester. So the more that you have of the community involvement, the better you can determine whether or not that cat is at risk or not at risk. And that's information that then can be passed along. The other thing, too, is if there's a cat that's out there that, you know, if our low-cost spay-neuter programs take a deep dive and we really have a lot of, you know, cats that are indoor-outdoor but are already spayed and neutered, if we bring that cat in and it's already been spayed or neutered, then we realize that there is an advocate for that cat out there, or there was an advocate for that cat at some point in time. And that, so maybe it behooves us to return that cat back to the community. But if there's a cat that hasn't been spayed or neutered or microchipped even. I mean, we're now doing the clinics with microchipping to even better identify, you know, is there a way for us to keep peeling back those layers of the onion to better know the cats in our community? I certainly know in Newburyport, we knew a lot of the indoor-outdoor cats that came into us as frequent flyers, and we knew who owned those cats, and, you know, we microchipped them and put them back, and so we would always know what to do with those cats. But that's a really targeted project, and can we ever hope to get that targeted with all of our communities?
Yeah, and I think if there's caretakers that really know their population really well and know the animals intimately, I think that's great. I think I would also say that I'm observing some situations in which caretakers might be making presumptions based on tiny pieces of information. So I think that there is sometimes in animal welfare, our tendency is to look towards the most negative potential and the bleakest possibility from humans. So I certainly have come up across cases pretty frequently in which a caretaker has seen a new animal in the feeding station that they're at, and then make the general presumption that after they've seen that animal two or three times, that the animal has been abandoned and is now part of their colony. But I think we lose sight of the fact that we're putting, you know, basically a buffet out for animals to come and feed from, and that coming to take a free meal from us doesn't necessarily indicate abandonment, even if they come for a free meal every single day. We certainly know that cats are creatures of habits, and they will continue to go back to the same location if they believe resources there. So I think we just have to really always critically think about what it is we are presuming and what are the things that we really do know, and maybe try to take steps to see if we can get more information, use that cat to help us with that process. Like if it's a friendly cat that shows up in a colony that I'm feeding, is it best just to sort of presume that the animal is abandoned, or could we put a paper collar on it and ask the person to call us if the animal returns, or do something else that might help us get a better, or look at the overall physical condition of the cat to determine whether this cat is more likely indoor or totally outdoor cat. So I think for me, it's just a good conversation to keep having, because I think I'm also really sensitive to that. I'm not sure it's always best for an animal to go into a shelter, even if there's space, that rehoming isn't necessarily the best process for every animal if they've been successful in the home that they're already in. I would rather them be there than try to find them a new home that they may or may not do well in.
Well, I think ultimately, Mike, that's kind of the essence of where we're going with the future of animal welfare, is that our roles, I believe, are going to morph more and more into becoming organizations that help support the bond between people and animals where they are, versus that us taking them from whatever situation, whether that is from the field, from a home, whatever, wherever that may be, and then rehoming them completely. I think our role is shifting to putting the resources out into the communities and keeping that bond together versus finding someone else.
Yeah, I think that definitely makes sense, and spreading that net even farther and the communications into the community.
So, hey, Community Cats podcast listeners, we're taking a quick pause here to create a part two for this great interview with Carmen and Mike on the Carmen and Mike Show. So tune in next week for part two of our show with Carmen DiCenzo and Mike Kiley. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Community Cats podcast, and don't forget to subscribe.
Thank you for listening to a Community Cats podcast. I would really appreciate it if you would go to iTunes, leave a review of the show. It will help spread the word to help more community cats.